You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Back for our usual discussion about the week in state politics is Rob Schofield of Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray from the Conservative John Locke Foundation. Hello to you both.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
All right, the governor and the legislature fighting again. It's just another week, of course. Again, it's over this fund related to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, a mitigation fund. It seems to me that the governor has lacked some transparency and detail in how this $57.8 million fund, which we should know doesn't exist yet, would work and flow. It also seems to me that the Republicans have pounced potentially a little bit early in some spots, pointing to potential conflicts of interest. This is politics, after all. There are potential conflicts of interest lurking everywhere. What is at the heart of this right now?
I think the heart of this is the constitutional question as to who has the authority, which branch of government has the authority to accept funds and to appropriate funds. Under our state constitution, it says that the General Assembly, the legislative branch, is the branch of state government that is authorized to take that money in through the state treasury and then to appropriate that money. That has been the heart of the question. There's been questions that have evolved from there, lots of different questions. But the heart of the matter is the governor authorized under our state constitution to appropriate this money as this $58 million has been set out?
So if lawmakers went ahead and essentially said, we now have authority of this fund, why isn't it a moot point? Why is it still about the constitutionality if they've, you know, reined this in, so to speak?
Well, I think because there's continued questions, as you mentioned in the press conference this week, and the Senator Berger's response, at least, was that, some potential conflicts of interest. You know, Jeff, since this has all come up, just in the last day or two, we've also learned that there is another $11 million mitigation fund that was set up through DEQ as part of the permitting process. And then Tom Campbell, the host of NC Spin, has reported just in the last day that there may have been a deal that was worked out with this $58 million that was completely outside of the governor and that he really didn't know about it. But when he did find out about it, he did not take it to the General Assembly to say, hey, here's this money. It's your responsibility to appropriate it. Let's work on this together as to how to disperse this $58 million. So it just continues to be question after question after question.
Let's take a step back here. First of all, the point that the central point that needs to be raised about this debate over this mitigation fund, of which there are plenty of examples in North Carolina history of mitigation, such mitigation funds being negotiated and paid out, is the absurdity of including the legislation dealing with it in a bill that was about helping children and helping solve the class size crisis that the General Assembly created. So first of all, I'm willing to concede that there's lots of debate that could be had over this mitigation fund. There are a lot of people in the progressive side of the aisle who are very concerned in the first place about the governor's administration even setting the stage for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline to go forward. I think there are a lot of real serious questions about that. There are serious questions about what this mitigation fund would actually accomplish. But the first point that needs to be made is that it was outrageous to include this in legislation that was about fixing this class size situation. This is just a ridiculous power play on the latest ridiculous power play by the General Assembly vis-a-vis the governor. The fact that they also included the change with respect to the Board of Elections and Board of Ethics enforcement, or whatever we call it these days, was also ridiculous. It was an absurd thing to include that in the legislation. So that's the first point that needs to be made about this. The other point that needs to be made is that at this point, because it was simply a memorandum, as I understand it, a memorandum of understanding between the Dominion and the folks building the pipeline and the state, there's no money there. This was a voluntary agreement by the would-be pipeline constructors. So if the legislature wants to come in and purport to invalidate it, it's quite possible that it's just going to go away. So there's lots to be discussed here. I'm willing to concede that there's lots more light that needs to be shined on it, lots more discussion that needs to be had, but it was absurd to include it in legislation that was about an essential fix for our public schools.
The Memorandum of Understanding, not a legally binding document,
right,
as I understand it.
Correct.
We're in agreement there.
But let's also point out that, you know, this isn't an agreement between Dominion and the state. This is an agreement that the governor's council signed off on.
But to be fair, maybe this is semantics, but isn't that an agreement with the state? He's not acting as
Roy
Cooper.
Well, he's acting on behalf of the state.
Sure.
But here's the point. Is the governor authorized to act on behalf of the state to accept these funds and to disperse them? You know, it says in the Memorandum of Understanding that he will execute this money by executive order to go for three things: mitigation, economic development, and renewable energy, without any kind of restraints or specific allocation of that money. That's the job of the General Assembly. But that's what it keeps coming back to.
There are plenty of examples. I defer to experience and expertise here. Just give me one or two.
I mean, there have been examples through the years, for instance, where the Attorney General has negotiated settlements in litigation, negotiated settlements in would-be litigation with adverse parties in which they have agreed to contribute funds to the state. And it's not my recollection that those funds were then appropriated by the General Assembly. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's actually a record of this kind of negotiations happening in the past. It's an area, I'm willing to concede, it's something perhaps we need to look at, needs to be thoroughly vetted out, but the idea of including it in class size fixed legislation, attempting to invalidate it, and putting, you know, this power struggle between the legislature and the governor into that area was I think, a serious mistake.
And I acknowledge that was done. We all acknowledge that was done for political reasons, to try to hamstring or put the governor in a small box. Do you agree that was procedurally. It's one of the. I mean, they're just combining things. Whether the Democrats did it 20 years ago or not, it's not great government.
Absolutely, and it wasn't great government when the Democrats did it for decades, and it's not good government now that the Republicans have done it. I mean, and this is an example. You know, what we should have seen, and I will concede to Rob, you know, what we should have seen were really three separate bills that dealt with these three separate issues were in here. That's not the way that it's happened. But I think in the governor's press conference this week, too, to continue to dodge the question of where did this fund come from? And how is it going to be appropriated? And why wouldn't it run through the General Assembly, as the Constitution says, to continue to dodge that question by saying, well, the process was rigged?
Now, just for context, mitigation funds have also been established in West Virginia and Virginia, similar amounts of money. Those are going through a treasury where this one, at least from the Memorandum of Understanding, which is not, again, a legally binding document, would be put in a third-party escrow account. And I think that's a little bit more legitimate of a B for a question.
If the legislature was really interested, though, in this whole, you know, it's just sort of humorous to me that this General Assembly that makes secrecy and behind closed doors negotiations and lack of process and lack of open debate sort of their trademark, now comes in and tells us, oh, we should have had open debate about this. We should have had open discussion. And by the way, with the bill we're passing on it, we drew behind closed doors and we put it in a conference committee report that nobody could amend and nobody could offer any changes to or really even debate. Give me a break.
First of all, I think to kind of dodge the questions and the real issues here behind, you know, political barbs going back and forth is not addressing the real issue. Jeff, you mentioned the mitigation funds. And yes, Virginia had a very similar situation that we did with the pipeline going through Virginia. There was a mitigation fund that was set up. But the difference between what this Memorandum of Understanding does and the Virginia Mitigation Fund was that in Virginia, it was very specific as to, of the fund, mm-hmm. X number of dollars is going to go to protect against this environmental danger. It was very clearly defined. North Carolina's isn't. It says, here's $58 million, and you can spend it on mitigation. You can spend it on economic development. You can spend it on solar renewable energy without any real directive. Don't forget, too, that North Carolina's state constitution is not Virginia's state constitution.
Sure.
So the same rules don't apply in every single state.
We regularly come in here and we talk about everything the legislature is doing, the imbalance of power, which reasonable people can agree on. The governor in this state is just not a particularly powerful governor, period. However, I mean, this mitigation fund was negotiated by the governor. This might be a throwaway question, but any thought on why they, the legislators, didn't just go ahead and negotiate this whole thing for however much they wanted and for whatever purposes they
wanted? I think
it's
probably because it never even occurred to them, the notion that there would be a need for mitigation. I think the environmental advocates and progressives in general raised some real concerns that this $58 million is a drop in the bucket and it's not going to solve the environmental problems and economic development problems that the pipeline will cause. But at least it's better than nothing, which is, I think, probably what the General Assembly would have done. They would have rolled out the red carpet and said, here, take this, and oh, hey, maybe we can help fund it too. I mean, at least the governor was trying to do something. I have no doubt that the General Assembly wouldn't have done anything along those lines.
Jeff, the assumption up to this point has been, well, the governor negotiated this $58 million fund. What we're learning, and again, Tom Campbell, the host of NC Spin, has a report that would indicate that this deal was negotiated and drawn up outside of the governor And, you know, the governor has said this was a voluntary contribution. It was not quid pro quo. It was not an exchange for any permits. You know, what we're learning is, and what we need to get to the bottom of, who did negotiate this? Who drew this up? What were the terms of it? And why is the General Assembly not the ones that are appropriating this money? So, you know, as we sit here, we had a lot of questions. This story has gone on, and just it seems like we answer one question or open one door, and it just leads to more questions. I don't think we're at the bottom of this, and I think there's still a lot more to learn.
I'm sure we're not, if Phil Berger and Tim Moore have anything to say about it.
Well, to keep, you know, Rob, really, to keep going back and forth that this is just a political fight, I think just masks, you know, some real serious issues that need to be taken care of and need to be addressed.
I disagree. I think it is exclusively a political effort to score points by a General Assembly that can't stand the idea of the governor ever having a victory and looks for every possible conceivable way to cut back on his powers or to expand their own.
I will note that election filing did begin on Monday. You can roll your eyes at me and say, oh, here's the cynic with his next question. Shifting gears, election filing did begin on Monday, and we're seeing just a slew of candidates from across the state. At the same time, several retirement announcements came, two noteworthy ones, one on each side of the aisle. Republican John Blust of Guilford County he's in his 10th term in the General Assembly, and Mickey Mashaw, who was the third African-American elected to the General Assembly in the 20th century. He was first elected in 73, and I believe he's been there 30-plus years now. Not all of that. He hasn't been there consecutively since 73. Mashaw from Durham, Blust from Guilford. A lot of institutional knowledge, both characters for those of us who are around the building. What is lost for the General Assembly with the departures of those two?
Well, you know, I think there's we used to have this notion that we have to have term limits, you know, that we should send legislators packing after a few terms. And I think people like Blust and Mashaw prove why that's probably not the case, that wouldn't be a wise pattern. Having that institutional knowledge is important. It gives us people in the General Assembly who have more knowledge and can fight back against lobbyists and entrenched permanent staff who would otherwise have much more knowledge than the lawmakers. Mashaw and Blust have probably forgotten more than a lot of other people in the North Carolina political world know today. So, I mean, it does show that having veteran people in the General Assembly can make a difference for institutional knowledge and memory in passing good laws.
And I think I agree with Rob completely. I think the historical knowledge that they bring, the experience of the process, you know, Mickey Mashaw was the appropriations chair in the House for many years. So, I mean, he knows his way through a budget probably better than anybody else does, how they're put together, how they should be put together. And then, so you have that. But for these two specific lawmakers, and you know, Jeff, we have people who retire every year. We have new people that are elected to the General Assembly. So there's this kind of this constant churn that occurs. But with these two in particular, long-serving members, I think most people who are associated with the General Assembly, regardless of your political feelings or leanings one way or the other, have tremendous respect for both of these men. They have certainly served with distinction, not only their historical knowledge, but what they have contributed to the debate for years and years and years. And for Mickey Mashaw, for me personally, I have, so after watching this, I haven't been there as long as he has, but the time that I have been doing this, you know, his commitment to the African American community, to his knowledge and his deep, deep commitment to civil rights is something that I think many of us who have watched this and know him have tremendous respect for. For Representative Blust, you know, he has been one that has stood on the floor year after year after year and challenged good government, challenged the process, challenged the way that things are done. And again, you know, tremendous respect for him. So they're both going to be missed. I don't think either one of them can be replaced. I don't think anybody can be. The unique things that they brought to the table into this deliberative body, I think, have enriched the General Assembly. And I know for those of us that cover it regularly, have made the job fun.
Lawmakers departed this week with the intention of not coming back until May 16th. I'll believe that when I see it. What are we expecting, I guess one or two things from each of you, during this? It will not be a quiet time. They're just evidently not going to be here for a while. But what's maybe a leading thing that you're keeping an eye on for the next couple of months?
Well, we continue to very closely follow this effort to raise and remake our state court system. I feel as if that has not been abandoned. We continue to see new maps coming forth, even though some our reporter Melissa Boughton demonstrated this week that the legislature didn't even the language of their legislation didn't correspond with the maps that they put out. But there seems to be a deep effort, a deep commitment on the Republican side to remaking the state judiciary, perhaps even once again making a run at packing the state Supreme Court. So that's something we'll be watching very closely.
Actually, we are also watching that. The changes to the court system, really primarily how judges are elected. And as a matter of fact, the John Locke Foundation is holding a panel and discussion on May 7th at Campbell Law School, bringing in some academics and some experienced jurists to talk about the different ideas that are out there, kind of try to get above the political fray of what the discussion has been and have a very thoughtful discussion on that. So that's certainly something that we're watching. A couple other things that I'm watching very closely is the committees and the oversight committee. Are meeting a real concern about health care in rural areas of North Carolina. There are a couple of oversight committees. There's actually a committee set up to look at access to health care in rural North Carolina specifically for that. That's something that we should all be concerned about, whether we live in areas like I do where there's the best medical schools within a short 10-minute drive of my house, or we're in rural North Carolina, the 30 counties that don't even have an OBGYN. So that's something, I think it's a problem that the General Assembly is really grappling with. They're using this interim to bring in experts, think about things, think about ideas. And then we're also keeping an eye on some of the rules that are being put in place, a rulemaking process, what that ought to look like, what oversight ought to look like, making sure that rules that are put into place are done thoughtfully and with appropriate oversight are some of the things we're looking at.
The only thing else that I neglected to mention was the issue of capital improvements for schools, school bonds. I think that's clearly an issue that will be discussed. Governor Cooper did a good job this week of explaining how this quick fix we've got on the class size chaos problem still doesn't address the overwhelming multi-billion-dollar need for new school facilities around the state. And it seems to me that that's got to be something they'll be discussing in the short session and in the months leading up to it.
One final topic, admittedly a terrible and somber one, in this extended conversation we're having here. Parkland, Florida was added to the list of infamous sites in our country this week. You can, we don't have time to list all of them, but you know, I think of Columbine and Blacksburg, Eagle, Colorado, I believe it was Eagle, Colorado, the movie theater, Aurora, Colorado, excuse me.
Right.
There was a nightclub in Orlando. There have been church shootings and plenty of school shootings. It's terrible, obviously. I don't think anybody refutes that, disputes that. And I absolutely hate to say this, but it feels inevitable that not only will there be another one and another one soon, because there have been 18 school shootings in the country this year, it feels inevitable that there's going to be one here at some point, that there's going to be one close to our homes. I hate to say that, but that's how I feel. Thinking proactively, not reactively. I mean, this is it's become part of the culture. It's become a regular happenstance in the news. Is there anything that can be done, that should be done, that might help with what is becoming something that we just – it feels like we see more and more often? Rob?
You know, there was this – this is sort of really dark, but there was a headline a couple of years ago in The Onion, which is this dark, you know, it's this humor, online humor website, in which the headline said, "Only nation where this happened says there's nothing that can be done about it." It was referring to a school shooting, which is the sort of absurdity of the situation that we find ourselves in, where we are the only nation where this kind of stuff happens, and yet we throw up our hands and say there's nothing we can do about it. Of course there's something we can do about it. It's one thing to have a shooting with a handgun or to have an attack with a knife, as you might see in another country. But the notion that children like the man-child who committed this horrible crime in Florida this week can have access to mass killing machines that are designed effectively as machine guns to kill as many people as possible in as short a time as possible is insane. And that is not the case in virtually any other country in the world. And it is our own. At some point, the United States is going to have to draw the line, because as technology advances, we're going to have even more efficient killing machines that can kill more and more people. Obviously, guns haven't been perfected. They'll be even more perfected in the decades ahead. We have to establish some limits, and we have to recognize that it is an absurd situation that killing machines enjoy the same constitutional protections as speech and religion and due process of law. It's a crazy situation. We must pass laws to restrict these kinds of weapons.
And that's something certain that a lot of people have been talking about, you know, this idea of, you know, what do we do to prevent this? I mean, Jeff, you mentioned, you know, these have been happening all over the country. What if something happens close to our home? I would argue that all of these are close to our home,
sure,
you know, and touch us all just deeply. You know, the other thing that we've got to think about is the, you know, severe mental illness that these kind of things, this young man in the alleged shooter in Florida, already reports of neighbors, people that knew him, people in schools, you know, expressed, you know, he had real mental issues. I think that we are not addressing those problems adequately. In the last 15 years, with changes of how we treat mental illness, going from mental hospitals to community care, and I'm not a mental health expert. I couldn't begin to really speak to whether that, but it obviously is not working. Do we need to put more resources behind that? I know here in North Carolina, the General Assembly has recognized that as a real need, has put more money into mental health bills. As a matter of fact, have even waived the certificate of need requirements so that we can get those mental health beds built and functional and get people who need them in there. This is a multifaceted problem. You know, if you got rid of all the guns in the country tomorrow, it would not eliminate crazy people from going out and doing crazy things. You know, at some point, we've got to make a real commitment in this country, in this state, to address the mental health issues that are creating these kind of problems.
The only other thing I'd say is that at some point, we're going to have to make some sacrifices in this respect. It's not a problem that can be solved where we all just keep merrily going along and nobody gives up anything and it's all just, you know, peaches and cream. We're going, society and individuals will have to make some sacrifices, just as we have to pay taxes to live in a free society. I would argue we may have to pay some more taxes to fund mental health adequately. We may have to actually have some sort of limited restrictions on access to weapons, like we do with access to having a driver's license to drive a car. It seems to me at a minimum you ought to have the same standards that you have now to drive an automobile to own a mass killing machine.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Thank you both. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, you, Jeff.